Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM-LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, which, as you know, is one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the show, which you can access at radioinvivo.net. All of our past programs are there on the website on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show, so we hope you will take a moment to check that out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and it is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but never least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and also its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. And this week on Radio In Vivo, it is a great pleasure for me to welcome Dr. William Wetzel of Duke University Medical Center. Bill is on the faculty in the departments of neurobiology, cell biology, psychiatry and behavioral sciences, and medicine. He gets around. He is also the director of the Mouse Behavioral and Neuroendocrine Analysis Core Facility at the Medical Center. Bill earned his PhD from MIT in 1983, and after 10 years at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, he joined Duke in 1997. Bill and his colleagues have been doing many fascinating and important studies using mouse models of human neuroendocrine, neurological, and psychiatric disorders. And we're going to hear all about how these mouse models are developed and what they have to tell us about conditions such as ADHD, schizophrenia, depression, drug abuse, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and even Parkinson's and Huntington's diseases. Bill, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much, Ernie. It's very good to be here.
And I should point out before we proceed any further that we had the pleasure of having Bill's wife, Sheila Collins of the Hamner Institutes, on Radio In Vivo last year to fill us in on her groundbreaking research on metabolism. Bill, I'm curious, were you and Sheila colleagues when she was at Duke before moving her lab to what was then CIIT and is now the Hamner?
Actually, we predate that a little bit. We met as graduate students at MIT when we were both in the same department.
Oh, okay.
Actually, our labs were just down the hall from each other.
Well, it's a superstar team marriage in science. Well, Bill, I certainly want to spend, as I mentioned, a great deal of time, our time together today, learning all about your work with mouse models. But, of course, our getting together today is quite timely because, thanks to the Nobel Committee, suddenly the term knockout mouse is practically a household name. As most everyone in our audience is probably already aware, this week the 2007 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine went to three scientists who developed the methods for producing knockout and transgenic mice, including our own Dr. Oliver Smitty's right here at UNC Chapel Hill. As the Nobel Committee pointed out, the methods that they pioneered have become ubiquitous in biomedical research. Bill, can you fill us in a little bit about the history of these methods and where they've come and where they stand today?
I can talk, I guess, from the a behavioral perspective that in the past, people pretty much concentrated upon what was the behavioral phenotype of the animals, that maybe animals showed certain responses, suggested that they were anxious or depressed or something of that sort. And then what people would do then is that then they would then breed this population of animals and then try to study it in further detail to understand the behavioral antecedents of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, knockout mice actually turned the whole paradigm around because basically in behavior, you'd really like to know what the mechanisms that are involved in inducing the abnormal behavior. And with knockout mice, you first start by identifying a particular gene of interest. And this may have come through experiments that people had been doing in cell culture or even in flies, Drosophila, or in worms. And right. So you find the homologue in mice, and then you
the analogous gene.
Yes, the analogous gene. Mm-hmm. And that then you delete that, and then you ask, okay, well, what are the effects on physiology and behavior? And this actually has produced quite a few very surprising results, mm-hmm. primarily because one has to take into account that the living organism has many different physiological systems that have to interact among each other, and that you really don't see this in cell culture. And so by being able then to delete the particular gene, you can study effects that would be present.
So that gives you insight into what the function of that gene theoretically is.
Exactly. So initially when these techniques were pioneered by the scientists, the gene was knocked out or was deleted within the whole body. So that means that all of the tissues or cells where it would normally be expressed, that particular gene is lacking. Since that time, more refined techniques have been developed now where you can delete the gene in selected brain regions or selected organs or selected cells. And so now you can actually determine what is the contribution of those particular cells to in my case, a particular behavioral phenotype.
Mm-hmm. Or a particular specific system, I take it.
Exactly. And so that becomes so powerful then.
Well, Bill, how close are the mouse and the human genomes and physiognomies in terms of the translatability of these types of research results in the mouse to human applications?
Well, I think that there are both strengths and their limitations.
Okay.
An advantage with the mice that people use is that almost all the mice are inbred. And so as a result, then, the differences in particular nucleotide bases that are present in the genes are very similar. You don't have that particular thing in humans. And
we
so,
hope.
and because of the genetic homogeneity, then you can attribute specific effects then to effects on certain genes or environmental influences on particular genes.
Mm-hmm. Environmental influences being exposures or drugs or
enrichment or however, and so mm-hmm. then you can address many different questions that are relevant to humans in a very highly controlled environment. On the other hand, I mean, mice don't have certainly the cognitive abilities of humans, but nevertheless, you can devise various cognitive tasks that tap into many of the same types of behaviors. In addition, the genes that are expressed in mice and that are and expressed in humans are very highly similar. And
yeah,
so
okay.
and so there is a lot of translatability. However, with respect to psychiatric dysfunction, that becomes a little bit more iffy. And it becomes iffy because psychiatric diagnosis is based upon phenomenological criteria. That is in the case of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the patient may show hyperactivity, they may show impulsivity, they may show deficits in attention or in certain aspects of cognition. However, if you look across spectrums of patients, they are very heterogeneous in the expression of these symptoms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
With respect to mice, you can look at many of those same aspects. And so it becomes, I think, very powerful in that regard. In addition, in our experience and in the experience of many other investigators, the same drugs that would ameliorate or help to correct a particular psychiatric behavior mm-hmm. can also have effects in mice. And so that becomes, I think, tremendously important.
So there really is good translatability then between the models and what's going on in people.
Right. And so I think two other aspects. One is that by being able to use mouse models, now we are starting to get a little better handle, I think, on different genes that play roles in the expression of different abnormal behaviors. Despite that fact, you can never know what a mouse is thinking.
Right.
And certainly some syndromes, psychiatric syndromes, are associated with dysfunction in thinking. And so you cannot really address those.
Right, right. Well, Bill, how exactly do you produce one of these knockout mice? And why has all this been so productive in our ability to learn about the functions of individual genes?
Well, the way that you do it is that you first have to identify a gene that is of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've identified that, then you go in to a DNA library. And the library, it's like going downtown and you pull out a book. And so a regular library has many, many different types of books in it. And so when you go into a gene library, you have many, many different types of genes. And you have to be able to find the gene that you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't go to necessarily a card catalog and find it. But with the Human Genome Project and the Mouse Genome Project, at least you can identify then a nucleotide base sequence for the gene that you're interested in. And so what you do is that then you design certain probes, and these are called oligonucleotide probes, so that you can go in and be able to identify that particular gene.
I see.
And that then you have to sequence that and make sure you have what you think you have. And then once you do that, then you can take that particular gene and you can put certain selectable markers in it. And once you've put selectable markers in it, then you can take that gene and you can put it on embryonic stem cells. These are mouse embryonic stem cells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that you shock the cells momentarily, and that allows then the pores on the membranes of the cells to open. And so then your particular little construct goes, soup, it goes into the cell.
Okay.
Okay, well, once it's into the cell, then it has to be able to combine with the existing DNA that's there. And because the library that you used already was derived from the ES cells, the embryonic stem cells that you have,
mm-hmm.
that then the there are enzymes there that will recognize then that protein and they say, oh yeah, this looks very much like one that's already existing. So when the cells divide, then the DNA will open up. This particular construct will then be incorporated into the DNA, mm-hmm. and then you have to be able to find the cells that have it. And the way that you do that is that you had a selectable marker, and so you put a drug in the medium that's growing these cells, and the cells that don't have the marker die.
I see.
And so then you grow these up, and mm-hmm. then you can... put these into, you can inject these then into a mass of cells in the that are available, and then you put these into a pseudopregnant female, and mm-hmm. the female mm-hmm. then will give birth to a chimera. And the chimera means that usually the female is of a different genetic strain, and so the mice may be of different colors, black and white instead of black or white.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And this is one way to identify it, but then also you can identify it through by taking DNA from that animal and looking to make sure then that you have the deleted gene.
Indeed.
And then once you have that...
So these are the methods that for which the Nobel was just awarded.
That's correct.
You're describing.
Okay. That's right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But I understand it actually takes something like 25 generations to purify the knockout strain. Is that correct?
Well, actually, usually the chimera that you used to get in the past was usually a mixture of one or two strains of mice. Now you can go with just one strain. And so you get around a little bit of that problem, uh-huh. simply because different inbred strains of mice have different behavioral capabilities. However, if you have a mixed strain, that then you will usually do what you call backcrossing. So if you have one animal that is a mix, say, of a 129 strain and a C57 black strain, you can backcross them either to a 129 or C57. And after about 10 generations, you have about 99% of the respective genome that mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. Wish at that point.
I see. So the process has become more efficient.
Yes, but it still takes a lengthy amount of time. Nonetheless, at 5 generations, you're usually at 95%. I should state that usually when you have a mutant mouse, you want to find out what its phenotype is immediately. So people usually start testing immediately.
I see.
And if the phenotype is strong, it will persist even through backcrossing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that becomes very important.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, one thing I've been curious about with all this is, why is inbreeding so necessary? I mean, obviously, and this is coming from a lay perspective, in the human population, you know, we don't do that, hopefully. And one of the reasons for that universal taboo is that it can cause all kinds of problems down the line, you know, like producing New York Yankees fans, for example.
like to think it too, UNC fans.
Well, see, I wasn't going to go there. why is inbreeding not a problem in this type of work in the mouse population?
Well, actually, it can be a problem because often, so I would imagine the facility that has the most mouse strains that supply them to researchers is Jackson Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, Jackson Labs has bred the same mouse strains over and over again. And what happens from time to time is that spontaneous mutations arise, or that mutations were already there, and that they just become evident. And those are, I think, most evident in mice that have obese phenotypes. Those have been like the DBDB mice and the OBOB mice and the fat mice. But certainly, those are probably the best recognized examples, but along the way, there have been a number of different neurological phenotypes that have also arisen. And people now are recognizing that different inbred strains of mice also have mutations in certain genes that can contribute to the specific behavioral phenotype of that mouse. For instance, some mice can learn mazes much better than others.
Sure. So as an expert, you learn to control for those variables that may be outside of your experimental model then.
Right. Well,
just don't use that breed, right?
Right. Well, I will say that we try to control for that, but with things, you know, continuing to evolve and that we find out new aspects of the particular mice that we have under study, the particular inbred strain of mice, that then we learn more and then we have to have additional controls.
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about what you're doing, Bill, is that, you know, I would think it would be relatively, at least, easy to generate a mouse model of, you know, things like diabetes or obesity or cancer even. But how do you go about making mouse models for psychiatric conditions? You know, first of all, how are you able to do it at all? And second, how can you tell when you've been successful?
Well, I think that there are several approaches that that people have taken. And one approach involves that you can say, look, if I treat a human patient for a particular disorder, I have a high probability of success if I give them a certain drug. And so then the issue is that what is the particular drug target then that drug is binding to or is affecting?
Sure.
And so what investigators would do is then go in to the DNA library, and they would find that particular gene. They would fish it out, and then they would knock it out in mice and say, okay, so if this particular drug is good for treating anxiety, and if I knock out the drug target, then what do the animals show me? So that was an approach that a lot of people used.
So this is really kind of reverse engineering in a way.
Right. The problem with that approach is twofold. One is that not all patients respond to that particular drug, and so that suggests either that there's heterogeneity in the expression of the abnormal behavior. But the second thing is that it's not clear in the chain where you may be influencing the behavior. Like, in the brain, you have many different types of neurons, and there are many different types of circuits. And so by deleting a particular gene, where are you affecting that particular circuit? Are you affecting it way, way down from a place where the behavior is mostly affected, or are you affecting it more closely, or are you affecting other neuronal systems actually that are regulating the behavior?
Sure.
And so by knocking out the gene, yes, you may be able to recapitulate the certain aspects of the syndrome in the human, and you may be able to understand the mechanism much better, but it's not clear that you have uncovered the full mechanism in the human.
Right.
So the second approach then is to work closely with human genetics people, and both Duke and UNC have large efforts in human genetics right now.
Sure.
And so they study different populations of people, and they find genes then that are abnormal relative to some normal type of a control group. And so what we do then is that then we say, okay, if that's a candidate gene for this disorder or this neurological syndrome, let's go in and let's delete this in mice and see if we can recapitulate it.
Right.
And in many cases, that has occurred. And that becomes extremely exciting because then often this approach then leads to whole new mechanisms, and that then opens up the possibility of whole new drug targets to treat then the disorder where it may be more effectively treated.
I see. Well, that is very exciting, and I do want to hear, in, as we mentioned, in some detail about some of those specific studies. But, you know, first I want to generalize just a little bit more yet. Bill, I understand that an important part of this research is the development of tests or assays to assess the response to the various exposures or stimuli to which the mouse models are subjected. Could you tell us about some of that work?
Sure. So usually when investigators drop a little mouse on our doorstep, we take it in, and often we don't have much information about the gene. It's like the investigator will say, gee, this animal was kind of acting a little weird in the cage, and can you look at it? Or they will say, I've been studying this particular protein or gene, or this gene or this protein product of the gene for many, many years, and I'm very interested in it, and it's expressed in brain. And so they will show me something that shows, okay, the protein expression in liver and lung and brain, and they say, there it is. Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that the brain is a very complex organ that has many different areas and many different cell types. And so with that information, it's not very informative. And so as a result, we usually start out giving a very generalized series of behavioral tests to see if the animals can walk, if they can, you know, if they have normal sensory function, etc. And then we have a few small tests that look at emotionality and a little bit of learning and memory and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the people that test them have, in our lab, have a lot of experience. And so they'll say, you know, Bill, it's like everything looked, you know, came out normal on these scales. But, you know, this animal kind of looks like or smells like it might have a little bit of a deficit in this domain. And so then what we'll do is that then we will take a battery of tests from that domain and put them through it.
Uh-huh.
Because any single behavioral test is not conclusive. It only gives you an indication of that. And
sure.
So you need to do multiple tests. And then once you've identified what you think is a particular syndrome, then you go to the shelf and you start pulling off drugs and say, okay, does the animal respond appropriately to the drugs that would be used to treat human patients?
Mm-hmm.
Or
mm-hmm.
if the particular abnormal behavior is not a main aspect of a certain psychiatric condition, that then you will look a little bit more broadly into the types of drugs to see if you can change the behavior.
I see. Well, that sounds like you have some great fun in the lab.
Well, we do, and there are a lot of undergraduates, and we even have some high school students through a Howard Hughes project
mm-hmm.
that come and work in the lab. And, you know, they get very excited because they're going to work with an anxious mouse or a depressed mouse or a drug-abusing mouse.
So. I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Bill Wetzel of Duke University Medical Center, and Bill is, among his many positions, the director of the Mouse Behavioral and Neuroendocrine Analysis Core Facility at the Medical Center, and we are talking about the use of knockout and transgenic mice to model psychiatric issues. Bill, one thing I wanted to ask you about, in researching for this, I see that the mouse genome was sequenced in 2002, and just this year, the Mouse Genome Resequencing and SNP Discovery Project sequenced the genomes of 15 mouse strains, 11 of which were so-called classical inbred strains, such as the ones you've mentioned, that have been used in laboratories for many, many years. Why are these sequencing projects, why are these advances so important, and how do they affect your work? Does all that data about genomic aspects make your tasks any easier?
I would say that it does. Let me give you a sort of a little bit of a serendipity.
Okay.
Is that, so one project that we were working on with doctors Ranga Krishnan, who's the chair of psychiatry, and also Dr. Mark Carone, who's in cell biology,
mm-hmm.
is that this particular project was looking at depression. And in that case, we were interested in some of the usual suspects for depression. We were interested in the transmitter systems, serotonin and norepinephrine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And those particular transmitters are synthesized through enzymes that are in the brain. The norepinephrine is synthesized through the enzyme tyrosine hydroxylase, whereby serotonin is synthesized by tryptophan hydroxylase. And over the years, tryptophan hydroxylase had been studied and it had been cloned, and a group in Germany went and knocked out this particular gene. And lo and behold, the animal had no behavioral phenotype. And so then the idea was is that, gee, there must be another tryptophan hydroxylase. And so they used this particular sequence to go fishing to see if they could find a sequence that would be very similar. And they found it. And so they fished it out, and it was found that there was another tryptophan hydroxylase. This was called tryptophan hydroxylase 2.
Okay.
So the Caron lab was very interested in trying to knock out this particular gene, and so they began to try to fish it out, and they actually began studying it at the same time, because it takes a long time to make a knockout mouse, in some of these other inbred strains. And they found in one of the other inbred strains there was a polymorphism. That is to say, is that there was a single base change in tryptophan hydroxylase 2.
In other words, a genetic variation.
That's right, a genetic variation. And so they cloned this, and they put it into cells, and they found out then that when it was expressed in cells to make serotonin, that the levels of serotonin were greatly reduced.
Okay.
They were reduced by at least 50%. Mm-hmm. And so then they went back to the mouse and looked in the mouse, and the levels of serotonin were also reduced by a comparable amount.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was very interesting because the pharmaceutical industry had been using this particular mouse strain as a strain to study depressive-like behaviors and response to different antidepressive drugs. So,
many of which affects serotonin levels. Exactly.
So the Krishnan and Caron labs were very excited by this. And so then they began to look into populations of depressed patients that were there. And in a cohort, this was also with Redford Williams. And so in a cohort of patients, they found a set of patients that had major depression and were not very responsive to selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, mm-hmm. antidepressants.
Which are notorious for being quite variable right. amongst populations
right.
and, in terms of their efficacy.
And so then they got the DNA from these patients, mm-hmm. and lo and behold, they found that there was a polymorphism here.
Wow.
And when this was then expressed in cells, again, the levels of serotonin production were really decreased. And because the idea, one of the ideas of depression is that levels of serotonin transmission are reduced, this was now very exciting because one had actually identified a gene that was important in depression. And so since that time, what has been done is that this sequence now, the human sequence, has now been knocked in to the TPH2 locus in mice, replacing that, so that now all of the mice have the TPH2 mutation.
Okay.
And these animals do, in fact, show a depressive-like phenotype, and in many human depressed patients, anxiety is also a comorbid feature.
Mm-hmm.
And so these animals also show enhanced anxiety. And aside from that, it's also been known that serotonin can affect social interactions or aggressive behavior, and these animals also show differences in aggressive behavior. So it's very exciting then to going from studying to identifying a new gene to finding that it is abnormal in a mouse, to then finding it is abnormal in a human patient, and then to actually making that particular mouse to be similar to the human patient and finding the same syndrome.
Which allows for a lot of experimentation that would not be possible in the human population.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is fascinating, Bill, and brings to mind one of the questions I was hoping to get you to enlighten me about. You know, generally speaking, does the chicken or the egg come first in this kind of work? Is the research question the driver of when and how you might generate a particular mouse model, or as often as not, does the availability of a mouse model facilitate the asking of the research questions themselves?
Well, I think it's both.
And
I can say that, you know, I actually work both sides of the street. And so we have mice that have particular genes that have been deleted that we're studying, but we also have mice that have been identified to have a particular behavioral phenotype.
Mm-hmm.
And that these mice have been selectively bred for many, many different generations. And so we are now studying them, and that we are trying to identify, well, what's kind of, you know, wacky in them besides the behavior? It's like, what is wrong with, say, signaling between cells, or is there some neurotransmitter change, mm-hmm. or what's really accounting for these behaviors? And so we're actually using both approaches.
So it can go in either direction.
It can go in either direction. And it should be stated that when one looks in a manual to diagnose psychiatric disorders, like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual,
DSM, as it's known in the trade, huh?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That you, when you read a particular syndrome, it could be major depression or general anxiety or whatever, you find that there are a lot of different features in it. It should be pointed out that not all patients that are diagnosed with those disorders exhibit all of those features.
Sure.
As a result, the patient shows different endophenotypes of those features. Mm-hmm. And mice are the same way, is that mice, when you knock out a particular gene, probably don't show the full-blown syndrome as most humans do, but they will show certain features. And by showing certain features, then, that allows you to understand what are the mechanisms then that underlie those particular abnormal behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what it's all about, is identifying those mechanisms, right?
Exactly, because in some syndromes, like in schizophrenia, you find that there are a host of different behaviors that are affected. And some drugs that are used to treat the disorder are more effective in treating certain symptoms than others. For instance, cognitive or social aspects are usually not handled very well by typical antipsychotic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issue is that what other drug regimen would be important to incorporate in this so that the patients can feel some relief?
Sure. Well, you know, certainly one of the syndromes that I know you've been looking at and have come out with some really interesting work about, and I'd like to get you to describe it in a little more detail, is the successful development of a mouse model for obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. Now, is this a little critter that washes his paws 30 times a day? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, that's actually a very interesting mouse, and let me give you a little bit of a background.
Please do.
In that is that Guoping Feng had been studying, he was very interested in different proteins that can that are important in excitatory neurotransmission. And a major protein that's important in that is one called postsynaptic density 95. And 95 means that this particular protein on a gel just migrates at 95,000 molecular weight.
Okay.
So this particular protein serves as a scaffold. And on that are put other proteins. And other proteins that can be on that consists of different types of receptors as well as different types of signaling molecules. And aside from that, you can have other proteins that can also bind to it. And one of these other proteins are called SAPAP proteins. And there are four different SAPAP proteins. And Guo-Ping Feng showed where they were expressed in brain. And so he was very interested in those. And so he started knocking them out. And one of the genes that he knocked out was SAPAP3. Mm-hmm. And it ends up that that gene is highly expressed in a part of the brain called the striatum. And the striatum is an integrative area that is important for many different types of behaviors. But at least in obsessive compulsive disorder, it is thought to be one of the key regions. And the striatum also communicates with neurons that send projections or signals down to the striatum, and the striatum through a rather circuitous route also sends signals back to the cortex. And so this was thought to be abnormal. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it ends up that many patients, maybe 65 to 70% of patients that are diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder are responsive to selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So the idea was is that, okay, it must be a serotonin mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Or antidepressants.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there was also evidence that it may be involved with dopamine, which is highly secreted in the striatum. And there was also some evidence that glutamate may be involved.
Mm-hmm. All of these being neurotransmitters.
Right. And so OCD affects about 2% of the population, and people have been interested in it, and they've tried to develop different models, and people have tried to develop different pharmacological models and different genetic models. And so Guo-Ping developed a genetic model. And so he brought the mouse to us and said, well, you know, Bill, these animals show enhanced grooming, but, you know, do they show other types of weird behaviors? And so we put them through a screen, and we found out that the animals showed high anxiety and that the anxiety was very responsive to selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or antidepressants.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we did a whole series
so you,
of...
You actually gave him Prozac, right?
We gave him Prozac, exactly.
And it's a public station. We can say the name.
And so it not only reduced the anxiety, but it also reduced the repetitive grooming behavior that the animals showed.
So it really addressed the OCD-type behaviors.
Right.
Okay.
And we also did experiments with an electrophysiologist in the lab, Dr. Kalakos. And so she did recordings from slices of striatum and also found that there was abnormal glutamate signaling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then some of the final experiments then were seeing if we could rescue the behavioral phenotype or the electrophysiological phenotype.
Right.
And so what Guo-Ping did in this case was is that he said, look, if SAPAP3 is highly expressed in striatum, and if striatum looks like it's the area that's involved in OCD, suppose that we micro-inject into the striatum and give back this particular gene.
Right,
and
so you're knocking in instead of knocking out.
Right. And he did this through viral injection.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. it ended out that this was able to correct not only the behavioral phenotype, but also the electrophysiological phenotype. And mm-hmm. so then what one has identified in this case is that they have identified in mice a gene that looks like can regulate OCD-like behaviors. And now the task to see is to go back now to human patients and see whether there may be polymorphisms or mutations then that mm-hmm. are present in this gene in that population.
Right. And might that ultimately translate eventually into new novel therapies?
Absolutely,
humans?
Because that was the SAPAP3 is a totally unexpected target. Mm-hmm. And so now the issue is that we need to know several things. One is that we need to understand what are the molecular, cellular, and biochemical mechanisms that SAPAP3 interacts with other proteins, and how does it affect those other proteins.
Sure.
And then I think once we know that, then we can try to design pharmaceutical agents to be able to affect then that particular protein.
Absolutely. And that happens down the line, but I'm sure that that's very exciting to have that kind of candidate. And as you mentioned, the idea that the glutamate neural circuitry might be implicated was not really expected. Do you think that particular circuitry may be implicated in other neurological conditions?
Absolutely. And we're starting to look at that more broadly. I mean, When you publish a paper in a journal, they often like it to be, well, you know, is it this or is it that? And so we said in the paper that it was OCD or obsessive compulsive like behaviors. And there are a number of other psychiatric dysfunctions that can show some of these repetitive like or have OCD features. Mm-hmm. And so it may be the case that the SAPAP3 is not only relevant to OCD patients per se, but it also may be associated or related to dysfunction in other psychiatric domains.
I see. So this could be, in essence, a very, very important gene in the scheme of things.
Absolutely.
I mean, we know that these kind of conditions typically, I'm sure, involve varying expression in hundreds of different genes, but you got to start somewhere, and so this might be one of those like master regulator type of genes that is at the bottom of all this.
Right, and so it could be SAPAP3, or it could be one of the interacting proteins mm-hmm. associated with it.
I see.
And so that's why this becomes, I think, very exciting, because then...
And that's what keeps you all in the lab.
Exactly. That's what keeps us in business.
There you go. Well, Bill, I understand that you and your colleagues have also developed a mouse model for Alzheimer's disease, which has led to an important discovery about the role of a protein that recycles the neurotransmitter acetylcholine.
Yes, we have. We are actually very early into those types of experiments. That work was published with a collaborator in Brazil, actually, and mm-hmm. also with Dr. Mark Caron.
Sure.
And in that case, there was a gene that was associated with the vesicula uptake of acetylcholine, and that animal actually didn't die, and it showed some symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
We also have another mouse that may be very interesting in that regard, and I should state that a lot of psychiatric dysfunction is usually attributed to the same neurotransmitters over and over again. Those mm-hmm. usually mm-hmm. consist of norepinephrine or dopamine or serotonin or acetylcholine, as you've mentioned, or gamma-aminobutyric acid or glutamate. Mm-hmm. And this particular animal has a mutation in a peptide processing enzyme. And peptides are known to play important roles in in neural function as well as endocrine function and immune function, etc.
And that's a big wave of pharmacological development, is it not?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up that this particular protein can is involved in processing the amyloid, the AB amyloid, and
Which goes on in Alzheimer's patients to form the plaques we've heard so much about.
Exactly. And so it ends up that these animals, there's a buildup of amyloid in these animals. And in addition, they do show some cognitive deficits that are present. And we're just starting to investigate that. Currently in the lab, we have more than 40 different mutant mice that we're studying, and it's kind of difficult to keep track of all the different things. So we have this big chart up on the wall, and that's the way then that we're tracking the animals and being able to figure out the phenotypes.
That's quite an Excel spreadsheet you must have going there.
Exactly. But it's very exciting because I think it's starting to provide a whole new insights into psychiatric and neurological dysfunction.
Absolutely. Well, another study I wanted to ask you about, Bill, that you contributed to was a 2005 publication about amphetamines reversing Parkinson's disease symptoms in a particular strain of mice. Where does that line of research stand?
Yes, that research was done in collaboration with Raul Ganetnikov and Dr. Caron. And so in that case, we had actually Raul had described some years ago in a very interesting neurochemical result with this mouse. So this particular mouse that we were studying was the dopamine transporter knockout mouse. Mm-hmm. And so the dopamine transporter is a target, or one can say that one of the proteins that amphetamine or cocaine will bind is the dopamine transporter. Mm-hmm. And the transporter is very important for removing dopamine from the synapse once it has been secreted by dopamine neurons.
Mm-hmm. And dopamine is implicated in Parkinson's.
In Parkinson's and schizophrenia and a host of other things. But a very interesting feature about this mouse is that it was found to have very low levels of tissue dopamine. And so this showed then that the dopamine transporter was very important in being able not only to remove a dopamine from the synapse, but that the recaptured dopamine was very important in helping to maintain tissue levels. So the tissue levels of dopamine in this case were reduced 70 or 80%. And in Parkinson's patients, one finds that in the that levels of dopamine are also reduced in striatum by a comparable amount.
Okay.
So Raul then developed a pharmacological model of Parkinson's disease where he gave a drug that was an inhibitor that would block tyrosine hydroxylase. And tyrosine hydroxylase is the rate-limiting enzyme to make dopamine.
Okay.
And so as a result, these animals were severely depleted. They were depleted like more than 90 or 95% of dopamine. And so these animals then showed all of the features of Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm. So with a pharmacologic treatment, he was producing a mouse model of Parkinson's.
Right. And so then the issue is that, okay, if you have this mouse and it shows then the Parkinson symptoms, then what can help to ameliorate this? And what he showed was is that certain types of amphetamine compounds actually can ameliorate or to lessen some of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. And so this was very exciting because the amphetamines will bind and can block uptake of the dopamine by binding to the dopamine transporter. And these animals don't have the dopamine transporter. So you know that's not a target.
Right.
The other targets were norepinephrine and serotonin. And so he gave norepinephrine and serotonin agonists and it had no effect. So this meant it was something else. And the something else, it looks like that helped to the way it looked like that the amphetamines were working were probably through a set of chemical or a set of transmitters that are very rarely studied. And these are called trace amines.
Okay.
And so he found that if he gave a trace amine in this case, that he also could ameliorate some of the behavioral symptoms.
I see. Well, we need to be certainly careful that anyone listening out there, to caution them, don't run out and take amphetamines if you have Parkinson's.
Absolutely.
As a result of this. I noticed that was stressed in the information I saw, and we certainly want to do that as well.
Absolutely.
That's shedding light on the mechanisms involved and may lead to some new treatments.
Yes, and so now there are some tracheamine receptor knockouts have been made, mm-hmm. and so now Raul is testing those animals in the lab and examining them. So I think through this we're starting to identify novel drug targets then that may be used to target Parkinson's disease.
I see. Well, there's so much exciting work going on in this area, not only in your lab and your colleagues at Duke, but around the country. There are other folks doing some pretty interesting mouse model work as well. I understand there's a new model for autism spectrum disorders.
Yes.
And I know that you guys have worked on schizophrenia, and there are some other ones happening as well. So it looks like a lot of fascinating work going on and very valuable work.
Well, I hop out of bed every morning and I'm excited.
Well, that's the bottom line about being a good scientist and being a happy scientist, right?
Exactly.
Well, Bill, it has been just a fascinating hour, and we certainly wish you much continued success with your work helping to characterize some of our most common and troubling neurological and neuropsychiatric disorders.
Yes, thank you very much.
And our guest today has been Bill Wetzel of Duke University. We've got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo, and you can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program and the programming on the station, we ask that you please do make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. We'll see you next time.